There are fewer than 30 men in the world qualified to drive Formula One. A mere half dozen, perhaps, to win. At this moment, I'm inclined to think you're not one of them.
No, you want to.
Keep up the good work, and there you have it.
There you go.
With the qualifying.
Welcome to F1Weekly.com. My name is Clark Rogers. I'm the host of the program. I'll be joined by Steve Faub, my co-host. This is podcast number 1097, June 2nd, 2025, Stephen.
This F1 Weekly podcast is brought to you by Yahoo Ads. Yahoo Ads get you the F1Weekly.com website for the ads and interest you. From cars to car parts, Yahoo Ads gets you everything that you could possibly want. Click on them. You know you want to.
Thank you, Steve, and keep up the good work, Yahoo Ads. On today's program, Piastri takes full control of the championship with another dominant victory in Barcelona. Flex wings. Remember flex wings? A complete dud, like LCH said. What a complete waste of money. And it turns out McLaren is even faster, as we saw Piastri in qualifying. To pit or not to pit? That is the question for Christian Horner and Red Bull. And Fernando finally scores points. Bravo, bravo, bravo. And Max will be eaten alive by the British press. That I guarantee, because they will have no mercy on this human being. And of course, we got more classic Nasser Hamid, which will be refreshing after the chaos we just saw, with another wonderful interview. This became one of his friends in motorsports because of NASA's intellect and Dan Gurney's love of motorsports. And this is a wonderful interview with Nasser and the great and legendary Dan Gurney. And yes, we do need your contributions to keep this program on the air. Just click on the Support F1 Weekly tab. You know you want to. So, wow. I mean, why do we even talk about qualifying, even though Piastri, absolutely amazing. 0.3 over Norris. Norris, the problem is Piastri is growing, getting better and better and better. And has good coaching on the side. You can tell he is in control. He's calm, cool, and very, very controlled. So I'm very proud of Piastri. Congratulations, because I believe he will be world champion at the end of the season, especially after the chaos that happened 6 laps before the Grand Prix. But let's not forget that we had a great start. Piastri nailed it. Norris, of course, lost it a little bit. Didn't want to get into an accident. It's not 2016 between Nico and Lewis. And certainly, Max took P2. And it was another impressive overtake and a good start for Max and Red Bull, where Tsunoda is absolutely nowhere. He is actually literally going backwards. I believe he was last, dead last in qualifying. So I know this car is really crappy, and only Max makes it look good. And I hope he gets a bonus just for that alone. But boy, after the start, everything settled. And I might as well just jump into it right now. Everything was fine until Antonelli, and At first, people were afraid, oh, the young man made a mistake. But no, another Mercedes power unit went kablamo, which is very unusual. An extremely reliable piece of equipment. And now we have Fernando in Monaco, now here. Clearly, you could see the smoke coming out of the back of the car. Now, it might not be a power unit. It could be some kind of other issues. A lot of manufacturers try to cover up any reliability problems. So, and tough for Antonelli, but my goodness, what happened after that? Safety car. And let's not forget, Lewis Hamilton had to give a position to Leclerc earlier in the race. We know how sensitive he is. He's been very, very much on edge, which is another thing I'm not very happy about. But I know these are all type A kind of personalities. I don't want to use the word boiling, but they're here to win, 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 baby. So it was a tough race for Lewis, but he was competitive. He came out, and Ferrari did pretty good. But we have to talk about the last six laps. Once Antonelli was out of the race, it was a safety car. And my goodness, you'd think they would have spoken in the evening, over dinner, after qualifying, mentioning to Max, by the way, all we have is a couple of used Pirellis we got at a junkyard and brand new hard tires that are about as good as used Pirellis that come out of a junkyard. But I don't think they told Max that. I think they left him thinking there may have been a set of mediums laying around. I don't know what they said. But when the safety car came out, of course, the top three pitted, and Max got stuck on a pair of hard tires. If you looked at the screen, everybody was on softs except for one guy at the bottom on mediums. And I can't even remember who it was, and it's unimportant. But even Max said, what kind of tires did you put on my car? And when they told him the hards, oh, but they dressed it up a little. Oh, they're brand new hard Pirellis. I could tell deep down he was going, oh, my goodness. Oh, dear. And sure enough, we had several oh, dear moments. These tires are so bad. He might as well have been on Pirelli-studded snow tires. Yeah, I mean, as soon as the race restarted after the safety car came in, a complete disaster. You could tell, no grip. He's suffering. And the blood is beginning to boil. And I really wish they had a barometer. You know, they have RPMs and all that. I want to see blood boiling. Because this was, and let's not forget, if you remember how Josh, his boss, his father, used to be, it was identical. A lot of boiling, but never fighting for a championship. Anyway, it was unbelievable. Leclerc hit him. Leclerc admits to hitting him, but he didn't want to get into the marbles. I understand that. This is racing. And then Russell comes around, bangs wheels. He was clearly in the wrong. Max was in the right, but the team tells him. So they put him on hard tires. And these guys have been working with Max for a number of years. They know putting on the hard tires was going to make him boil. And then to tell him to relinquish the position to Russell, that was it. It was full-blown boiling point, extreme. There was just no way Max's type A personality was going to be able to handle this with grace and love. And it boiled over. It was unbelievable. He actually pretends that he's going to give the position back, but how could he? He's Max Verstappen. This isn't George Russell. This is more like Schumacher, 94, 97. I mean, this is full-blown pro Senna boiling, and there was just No way. Of course he intentionally hit Russell. We know that. But the fact is, McLaren is taking off. They are going to dominate this season. They're faster than anybody. Congratulations to Piastri. Let's hear from George.
I mean, I was as surprised as you guys probably were. I mean, I've seen those sort of maneuvers before on simulator games and in go-karting, but never in Formula One. Ultimately, we came home in P4 and he came home in P10. So I don't really know what was going through his mind. It felt deliberate in the moment. So, yeah, it was a bit surprising.
Are you surprised with only a 10-second penalty? Because there were options for a black flag and other penalties.
That's not really my place to say, to be honest. Right now, I'm not even going to give it any thought because we've got our own problems to deal with, which is trying to make our car go faster. We were sort of destined to finish P4 today, probably ahead of Charles and behind Max. Obviously, the safety car at the end to shuffle things up. But it's down to the stewards to decide if it was deliberate or not. But obviously, you know, Max is such an amazing driver, and so many people look up to him. It's just a shame.
Let's hear from Max.
My first question has to be, was the move on George intentional when you turned in?
Does it matter?
I think so, to people watching.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's great. I mean, I prefer to speak about the race than just one single moment.
The moment itself got your 10-second penalty, though, and that pushes you back down to 10th, so it affects your driver's title hopes this year.
If there are any. So I think we are way too slow anyway to fight for the title. I think that was clear again today. We tried to do a 3-stop, and I think it was quite good. It was quite racy, but we also needed it because we had actually quite a bit of degradation on the tires. So I think that was good. Unfortunately, then, of course, the safety car came out at the end, and we basically ran out of tires to use. And the hard tire was clearly not the right tire. I mean, when you only have 6 laps to go, everyone could go flat out. And I was severely grip limited on the hard.
Just before that moment, would you rather be a sitting duck in third or a sitting duck in first had you stayed out for the safety car or not pitted when you did and just tried to cling on to
that? Of course, afterwards, we have to look at it again. Of course, new tires or at least fresh tires, they do make quite a bit of a difference as well. So I think no one really expected maybe that the hard tire was so poor. But yeah, when it was only 6 laps, maybe it would have been better to stay out, yes. But that's, of course, a bit easier to say right now.
And just finally for me, leading up to the end of the race there, you were saying in the car that the ride is completely broken. You were unhappy about Lawson and Behrman's tussle in front of you. And then on the radio, when GP came on and said, you know, you need to give the place back, there was a lot of frustration going on in the car. Is that what resulted in the move at the end of the race? Is that where it came from? Because you pull off something like the move in Imola, and we all see what an incredible driver you are. And it's horrible to see that shine taken off.
Is it?
The comment about that. I think so, for fans and for kids watching, I think so.
Yeah? Okay, well, that's your opinion.
Yeah?
Yeah. We leave it there.
All right, thanks, Max.
Thank you, gentlemen. And now, you know, let's all calm down and go into the library, into the archives, and listen to something more calm and soothing. And that's Nasser Hamid with Dan Gurney. Fantastic. They developed a relationship over the years that was really wonderful. Never any boiling, but just good motorsports conversation. So I want everybody to enjoy this. And Nasser, just want to let you know that I think about you every day.
We've got a full house today. We've got Steve Faub. We've got Nasser in the studio, and the producer is not too far away. Lots of happening good stuff. And my favorite line today, I have to put it out there right away, is Heikki Kovalainen's statement is, I don't like Nelsino. Nas, I want your opinion on this right away.
Well, first of all, hello to everybody. I was very surprised when I heard that and read that. And then it dawned on me, I said, these people are teammates. So I don't know what Nelsino has done to Heikki. Heikki is a pretty cool guy. And maybe he's feeling the heat or has some rumors of birds singing in his ear, you know. Start finishing race or PK will be pick your place. You know what I'm saying?
Of course.
Very surprising. If it was a different team, no big deal.
Yep, but I like that. It shows that PK is ready to go out there and just grab it.
Hi, I'm Louis Foster, and you're listening to F1 Weekly.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now this is a special moment in the program where Nass brings us one of his outstanding interviews. And for me, I call this interview a doozy. Nass, tell us who this man is, his name, and history. This is history.
Okay, Clark, this is with Dan Gurney. I met him at Laguna Seca. His son Alex was racing in the Can-Am Challenge. And Dan Gurney, I've known him personally. We're not best of friends, but I've known him personally for over 20 years. And, of course, all my life as a racing fan. And I got to tell you, one of the nicest people you can ever meet, not just in racing overall, always with a smile. So much so, many years ago, there was a book written by an Italian journalist called Ferrari's Drivers. And he interviewed Enzo Ferrari, his comments, and even in that book, which I have, it's called Ferrari's Drivers. Enzo was quoted as saying that Dan Gurney was always smiling, was always talking about his big family and all that. Just a very nice person. And as far as racing achievements are concerned, I used to work for a software company, and we had some people come from our French office, and this French guy was telling me that Dan Gurney is a legend in France. And, of course, he won the Le Mans 24-hour race in the Ford GT40 program with A.J. Foyt. And this was just a week or two after or before he won the Belgian Grand Prix at Spa in his own Eagle American-made car. Just a great racing driver. Jim Clark, you know, told his dad that Dan Gurney was the only driver he feared. And among his other accomplishments, he gave Porsche their only Grand Prix win, a French Grand Prix, and also gave the Brabham team their first Grand Prix win, which was also in France. And he was the guy who had invited initially Colin Chapman to bring his rear engine Lotus with Jim Clark to Indianapolis. So tremendous racing achievement. Then, of course, his team won the Indy 500 with Bobby Unser. So I asked him his observation on some of his drivers and some of the racing personalities. And we even talked about, after the interview, about Reims. And he was asking me, he was there about 8-9 years ago. He said, do they still have all the trees there? I says, no, they're all gone. And hopefully, you know, I'll be there this September and check it out. And I told him, hey, if I get there, I'll send you a postcard from Reims. So one of the nicest people you can meet. And it just shows when you go to a racetrack. I've seen him in action. When he was with the Toyota GTP program, you know, I was talking to him, and there were a couple of old gentlemen who, you know, asked me to come over. I went there. And these people said to me that, you know, we have followed Dan's career for 30 years. Can you tell him you want to say hello to him? So when I went and told Dan, hey, there are a couple of guys here, followed your career for 30 years, he says, okay, I must meet them. And he walked up to them and talked to them. Just a very, very nice person. And you don't see nice people like that in racing, at least these days. So I'm very fortunate that I got to know him and I was able to do this interview. And I thank him for his time.
Thank you, Nass. And now a conversation with Dan Gurney.
I'm here with Dan Gurney, American racing legend, winner of Le Mans, Grand Prix racing, winner in Indy 500, and most important, a very nice gentleman, somebody I have known for many years. Dan, how are you today?
I'm just fine, Nasser. Beautiful day out here. Looks like a great race coming up.
Recently, your son won his first major race at Mexico, a track where you won a Formula One race. What did that mean to you?
Well, he's been knocking on the door for a long time. He's been capable of winning for a long time, and things just haven't worked out. We know all about that sort of thing, but I was really thrilled, and it was a close race. If you were watching it, it was very close with Max there, and I had about 3 heart attacks, and then he finally won it. So I'm very proud, and it was very nice to take place on a track that I was involved with long ago, and that was very nice.
Now, you were in Formula One racing at a time when drivers who were fierce competitors were also friends, and now we are in an age where teammates don't talk to each other. What has changed in Formula One that you like and the changes you don't like?
Well, you're limiting it to Formula One. In my day, I think we were friends away from the racetrack, but not on the racetrack, and some of the people were just as vicious then as they are today. So I think it was true then that the one you wanted to beat the most was your teammate, and if you could consistently do that, and he was, had a very good reputation, well, it certainly didn't hurt yours, you know. But that's true today. It's a competitive thing, and but we were very good friends. And I know in many times afterwards, your biggest enemies, if they manage to survive and everything is all right, well, you become very good friends after you stop racing.
Now, talking of friends, I would like to take some names, and I would like to hear how you remember them as friends, as human beings, not as drivers, because we know who they were in terms of drivers. I'll start with a guy whose nephew raced for you and gave you a championship in GDP, Juan Manuel Fangio. His career was coming to an end when you got to Europe. Did you get to know him fairly well?
Well, I admired him. I had him way up on a pedestal that he had earned, and I really didn't. I spoke to him a little bit. I flunked Spanish in my early in high school, but he knew that I liked him a lot. I saw him when I drove a race in Cuba one time. He was there. This is long after he had been taken prisoner, but or hostage. But I admired him a great deal. And when Juan Manuel Fangio the Second, his nephew, drove for us, well, I could feel his uncle, the presence of his uncle, and a lot of the philosophical things that they discussed a lot. And Juan Manuel Fangio the Second was a terrific gentleman and an absolutely top number one driver too.
We interviewed him when he was here at the Monterey Historics last year. Did you get to meet him then?
The nephew then? Oh, of course.
Now, second person I want to hear your comments on as a person and friend is, of course, Jim Clark.
Well, you know, Jimmy and I were together on his career until it was abruptly stopped was essentially the same as mine, and we got along very, very well. We became teammates when I invited Colin Chapman and Lotus to, and put them together with Ford, and we started the Indy program. So Jimmy and I spent a lot of time together. I admired his spirit and the way he went about driving, and so he was just he was a great teammate. And in his case, I think we were more friendly with each other than many teammates had been, and I received some of my maybe the biggest compliment about my driving career from Jimmy's dad. But I admired his. He was not so worried about making his thinking about his career and his reputation. He'd like to jump into almost any different kind of car, and he often did, and he always did very, very well. So I mean, that was a different era, but I admired him a great deal for that, and I think he liked the fact that I could do a bit of that myself.
You mentioned Colin Chapman, one of the racing geniuses. Your thoughts on him as a person and as his contribution to motor racing?
Well, Colin was a very exciting guy to be around. When I was in the team that he was running, the Lotus Ford Indy effort, I learned all kinds of things that I still talk about today. You know, he had some very good sayings. One of them I remember was always be sincere, whether you mean it or not, which was typical of the kind of dry British humor, and we had a lot of fun doing that. And he used to, he spent a lot of time thinking about future, the evolution of cars and racing cars, and he made very precise notes and very, very small, written, so that if you're looking over his shoulder, it was going to be hard to read them. They were so small. But I think that those that were around him had a feeling, almost a confidence, that he was going to be able to come up with something better than the opposition would on more often than not, and that was a very special feeling.
Now, did you drive, co-drive, did you have Francois Sivert as a co-driver at Sebring one year?
Yes.
Any thoughts on him? I liked him very much, and he died, unfortunately, the year I started.
Yes. Well, Francois was, he exuded a great deal of energy and, you know, like he could jump over tall buildings kind of thing. And he was full of enthusiasm. He was a special-looking guy, and I liked him very much. Of course, that was our only get-together, and he was gone not too long after that, and a terrible shame. So I couldn't tell you a great deal about him from the driving standpoint. I think, obviously, he was very promising. Could have gone all the way.
Among the three races, the 67 Belgian Grand Prix, winning in your own Eagle, winning the Le Mans with Texas Tough AJ, and winning the Indy 500 as a team owner, which one is really special and dear to you?
Well, all three of them are very special, of course. And I don't like to get into the ranking game, but you end up probably... winning the Belgian Grand Prix in our own car with our own engine was pretty tough to beat nowadays. There aren't many people that could do that now. So,
or even then.
As a racer, it was that was a very special thing. The other one was, I think, my 10th attempt, 9th or 10th attempt at the Le Mans 24-hour race, which was a great race, still is. And AJ and I... we're already friends, and I think despite sometimes when he says things that he later probably doesn't care about, we're still very good friends.
Yeah. AJ?
He was a great driver, a great engineer in those days, before race engineers were on teams. Why, he could do all that himself, and he was on the forefront of the technology in those days, and he could drive as well as anyone, and so it was a tough combination. That's why nobody's won more IndyCar races than he has, even today.
Your Spa win obviously came at a great track. How would you compare Spa to the other favorite of almost every driver we talked to, Nürburgring?
Well, at the Nürburgring, it had more variation. It had a similar history, but I always felt that the Nürburgring was the one that was the most challenging. But in terms of high speeds, even with a 20-mile-per-hour hairpin, we were, you know, we averaged 148 miles an hour for a lap there. And so I always felt the Spa was the granddaddy of all the high-speed circuits. And I'm sure that some of my experiences at Indy helped me cope with the turns there, which was that. I mean, it was a fabulous place and beautiful setting, and dangerous as the dickens. So,
I was at Nürburgring last year. I drove through Adenau. Yeah. What a lovely setting!
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm sure that those that came before my arrival there at the Nürburgring, I got there first in 1958. And the track has been changed a great deal. It's been sort of tamed a little bit compared to what it was. We had no barriers whatsoever except for forests and trees, and there was a lot more bumps. You know, bureaucrats somehow don't like the fact that a place has history, so they try and fix it to make it into a freeway, and that sort of is too bad. It's still a very challenging track, as you well know. And but it was I'm just thankful that I had a chance to go there and to run there, and I actually held the lap record there on two different occasions.
Now, some years ago, a book was written called Ferrari's Drivers by Michele Fenu, and he had interviewed Enzo about his comments on his drivers, and he said about you what almost everybody says: always smiling, very nice guy. What I want to know is this: Ferrari was famous for politics to the team itself. Did you felt any politics when you were there as a driver?
I observed what I thought would come under the heading of politics. And Enzo was a racer, and he was a proud man and a pioneer and probably the biggest figure on the racing scene in the 20th century. So... that doesn't mean that he was always lovable and perfect, but the only pressure I felt was that I had the feeling that he liked what I was doing, and as long as I kept running the wheels as hard as I could, why, he liked that. So I never felt anything that was negative from him. The ones that I observed would maybe he could use the press to say things that might spur another driver to try even harder, even though he was already trying as hard as he could. And I think there's some truth in that.
Now, in IndyCar racing, when you had your team and you were supplying cars, Eagles, to other teams, a lot of great drivers drove for you. Among the drivers who drove for your team, you got to know, who did you like as a person that you enjoyed dealing with? Because racers can be pretty tough cookies.
Now, that's a losing question, because if I name one person, I've ticked off all the others that...
You can name quite a few if you like.
Bobby Unser was won a lot of races with us, and he demanded a lot of us, and we weren't sure. He was always giving the same back to us, but Bobby was a great driver for us. I think Juan Manuel Fangio II was maybe the most fun to work with, and needed the least sort of pushing. He gave 100% all the time, and we just happened to have a fantastic car at that time, and with the Eagle GTP car powered by Toyota four-cylinder engine, and it was it's still, I mean, the lap record here at Laguna now is still ours from 93, same at Daytona. And P.J. Jones set the one at Daytona, but Juan had engine trouble that morning, so he didn't get to go qualify. I don't know who else. I mean, lots of you probably haven't heard of Mike Mosley very much.
Of course I have.
Okay, well, Mike, when it comes to oval racing, why, there wasn't anyone any better. You know, all you had to do is give him a car that was pretty close, and he'd do the rest. That was fabulous. Tom Sneva was a very difficult guy to work with, but very, very capable. And we tried to comply with every request that he made. He was a funny guy. He used to go to other teams and discuss them, the tactics of what we should do next with the opposing teams. But anyway, he was also very good, but... I think, he knows.
Now, next question, you brought up the track record here in the GTP program. If you don't want to answer, I will understand. You were involved with Toyota. You were with them in GTU, GTO, GTP, Indy cars. And then all of a sudden, they dropped All-American Racers. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
I'd say that no one on this side of that particular situation remembers or was ever told. We were never informed. I think there were a lot of political factions in Toyota itself. And, if you happen to be on the wrong side of a politic or a particular internal debate, why, even though you were... you got painted with the same brush that the losing side did, why, that was it. You're gone. I frankly am very happy to have escaped that sort of situation. We were sort of naively loyal to them, and I don't think they returned it, so I'm very happy to be gone from that situation.
Can we expect All-American Racing back in some sort of racing?
Well... although Ali's not an employee of AAR, he's certainly involved in racing. And so to that extent, yes. And really it depends on what you see. I think Ali's older brother, Justin, would love to find a way to do it. And I hear some rumors of some things that involve this Grand Am series.
Quick question, I know you have to go. When you were in Formula One, and when I look at a result or anybody, you see three or four American drivers in the results. You, Carroll Shelby, Richie Ginther, Phil Hill. Now we have Scott Speed struggling to stay there. What will it take to get a good competitive American driver in Formula One, and do you see anybody on the radar?
Well, that's a loaded question. I think a huge amount of politics, a lot of bad advice has been adhered to, I think, and I think it really it takes the desire of people with enough money to do it properly. And I mean, you could stick Allie in one of those cars, and he'd be definitely in the top half immediately. And I say that without any hesitation. But how you get there, and if enough, there's enough desire for that with the people that control that amount of money, that remains to be seen.
Finally, how about a message for our listeners? We have a worldwide audience.
I'm, in some people's mind, I'm a legend, and I'm therefore...
Well, you certainly are.
And I think that the same things that made me love racing back when, you know, 50 years ago or so, are still true today. It's not always easy to see it in among the clutter of all the marketing speak, but it's there, and when you get the right teams and the right drivers competing, why, it's still a great sport.
Dan, you're not just a racing champion. I've said this to you before. You're a champion when it comes to being a real nice guy. Thank you so much. Great honor, and I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure, Nasser.
Dan Gurney, thank you.
Hello, this is Andrew McPhee with your F1Weekly.com trivia question. During qualifying for the 1997 European Grand Prix at Jerez in Spain, three cars qualified with identical times, the first time this has ever happened in Formula One history. Can you name the three drivers? And here's a hint, two of them were from the same team.
Our shout-outs last week, let's get through them now. The podcasters at F1Weekly.com.
Want to find out how much you know about Formula One? Are you interested in learning more about Formula One's history? Then have a listen to the Formula One Trivia Podcast, a weekly 10-question trivia quiz that will test your knowledge. Visit the website at www.f1triviapodcast.com to find out more.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now for one of my favorite parts of the program, Motorsports Mondial with Nasser Hamid. Let's spin the globe. Let's welcome Nasser back to the studio. Nasser, welcome back to F1Weekly.com studios. How are you today?
Thank you, and hello to everybody. And voila, the globe has stopped in France, your spiritual homeland. And we're going to start with Le Mans series. Ex-Formula One driver, and of course, these are races from the past weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Ex-Formula One driver Marc Genet took pole position in his Peugeot to put a smile on his and your face. Genet's co-driver is ex-IndyCar driver Nicolas Minassian, who used to race for Chip Ganassi's team. But victory went to another Peugeot driven by Pedro Lamy, another ex-Formula One driver. And Pedro Lamy is from Portugal, and local French driver Stéphane Sarrazin. More success for the Français, World Rally Championship in Argentina. Man, I like the big smile on your face, Clark. Sebastian Loeb and Citroën were the winners in round 6 of World Rally Championship. Third successive win in Argentina for Clark Rogers' homeboy, and also third win in a row this season. So he's doing pretty good.
Yeah, but there were some real weird issues with the Argentinian WRC segment.
Yeah, they
were canceling a number of legs of the competition because some of the drivers were late coming back.
Yeah, they could not ferry them and the cars on time.
Correct.
So they had to cancel some of the stages. Argentina is a big country, and you know, they probably don't have BART there.
Keep up the good work, Nas.
Thank you, sir. Finns and Ford Focus were second and third, Marcus Grönholm and Mikko Hirvonen respectively. Now we go to World Series by Renault, and they were racing at Nürburgring. Race 1 victory for Sebastian Vettel. He also recorded the fastest lap. English driver Ben Henley was second, and Alvaro Perez from Portugal was third. Charlie Kimball, whom we interviewed a few months ago from Southern California, was 16th. In Race 2, winner was 19-year-old Italian David Valsecchi, ahead of Felipe Albuquerque of Portugal, with Miguel Molina of Spain in third. Vettel was sixth in this race two, and Charlie Kimball was eighth.
Okay, Nas, before we wrap up Motorsports Mondial, I want to update on Kazim Manzour, who's in the KF1 series in Europe. I want to know where he stands, how he's doing. Give me an update.
Yeah, you know, his first race in the KF1 series, which is the top level of karting, name keeps changing, was this past weekend in a town called Ugento in the very south of Italy. And he finished fifth for the Alexandri karting team, which is very impressive because he's 15 years old and he's racing against top karters who have been in karting for longer than he has been racing. You know, some of the big names there are like in their 30s. So very impressive debut for him in the European karting championship. And this is a FIA sanctioned event. So coming fifth in your first race is very impressive. And you know, what is even more impressive, he started the final heat, the segment in 12th place and passed a lot of guys to finish fifth. So we'll keep an eye on him. And of course, not only a good racer, but also a listener of F1 Weekly.
Exactly. And he is a good racer and we are keeping our eye on him because he's showing a lot of talent.
Yeah. We'll see, you know, what's next.
Thanks, Nas.
And now, of course, we cannot do any segment without mentioning your favorite series,
Lunesca.
And they were in the capital of their NASCAR Nation, Richmond, Virginia.
Oh, boy.
Fourth win of the season for Jimmy Johnson. Kyle Busch was second. Local driver Denny Hamlin was third, with Jeff Gordon fourth. And did you watch the Kentucky? You know, we don't cover horse racing or bull racing or fighting here. But did you see the or follow the Kentucky Derby?
Believe it or not, I don't follow the Kentucky Derby, but I did follow the Queen's visit to America on C-SPAN.
Well, the King Richard Petty got to meet the Queen of England at the 133rd running of the Great Horse Race. And Clark, unfortunately, I am unable to verify reports both the King and Queen enjoyed tea and crimpets during a caution.
I believe it. I certainly hope it wasn't phantom debris.
Yeah, or a phantom crimpet, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Keep up the good work, Nas. Great information for the F1 Weekly listener. Okay, Nas is now got a really great concept here, and I think it's pretty cool, and that's why we've decided to allow it at F1 Weekly. And we got strict regulations here, Nas. But this is called Motorsport Memories One-Hit Wonders. And we're not talking music here. We're talking race drivers.
Yes, Clark. You know, over the years, many drivers have come and gone. Some have made a lot of, you know, splash, but they only have one win to show. Some were fairly obscure. And I thought, you know, the season going on and hopefully somebody will have their first win this year. Maybe Hamilton, maybe Kovalainen, who knows. So I thought maybe let's do a segment called One Hit Wonders, or a tribute to all the Grand Prix drivers who made it to the top of the world in Grand Prix racing only one time. And we appreciate that and we respect that.
Now I can think of a few right off the top of my head, but I'm not going to say a thing.
Yeah. So, and this is not in any order. It just, you know, came to my mind and I started writing these names. We're going to start with Joe Bonnier, a Swedish driver. His family was in the publishing business. His win in Holland in 1959 was the first win for British team BRM. And interestingly, BRM's last Grand Prix win also turned out to be the only Grand Prix win for the driver, as we shall see. Bonnier also won the famous Targa Florio in Sicily twice and also won the Sebring 12-hour race in Florida in 1962. And unfortunately, he was killed in a racing accident at Le Mans in 1972. Next is Lorenzo Bandini. He was born in Libya to Italian parents. His one and only win came at the 1964 Austrian Grand Prix at the Zeltweg airfield in a Ferrari. He was killed in a fiery crash at the 1967 Monaco Grand Prix. Bandini was successful in sports car racing, taking victories at Le Mans in 1963, Targa Florio in 1965, and the Daytona 24 Hours in 1967. Then we come to François Sivet, a dashing playboy with romantic eyes. François Sivet was teammate and nominated successor to Jackie Stewart at Team Tyrrell in 1973. He lost his life in qualifying for the final race of the season at Watkins Glen, same venue where he scored his only Grand Prix 2 years earlier, which would be 1971. Next is Jean-Pierre Beltoise. Beltoise was married to the sister of François Sivet, and his day of days came in the rain at Monaco in 1972. This was the last win for BRM in Formula One, In 1971, his license was suspended for a while following his involvement in the crash at the Buenos Aires 1,000-kilometer race, which cost the life of Italian driver Ignazio Giunti. Beltoise was pushing his car across the track right in front of the pit lane and grandstand when his Matra was hit by the Ferrari of Giunti and the car just burst into flame and poor guy was killed. Jean Alesi, Giovanni Alesi, born into a Sicilian family, became Jean Alesi when the family moved to France. Much was expected from him, especially after he put up a good fight with Senna at Phoenix in 1991. Highlight and only win of his career came on his 31st birthday in Montreal, the 1995 Canadian Grand Prix, and of course, driving at a Ferrari. Next is Alessandro Nannini. Lucky win came at Suzuka after Senna was disqualified in 1989. I'm sure you remember him getting together with Alain Prost.
Of course.
His Formula One career was cut short in a helicopter accident in which his arm was severed but was successfully reattached. He then drove in touring cars for Alfa Romeo, official Alfa Romeo team, and his sister is a leading Italian rock and roll star. And he's from the Italian town of Siena. Next, sir, is Gunnar Nielsen. Driving a Lotus Victory in the rain at Zolder in Belgium, 1977, was the highlight of this Swedish driver. He died of cancer only weeks after his compatriot Ronnie Peterson was killed following an accident in the 1978 Italian Grand Prix. And of course, Zolder is the track where Gilles Villeneuve was killed, and same venue Champ Cars will be racing this year. And you know one thing very interesting? Long time ago, when Danny Sullivan was totally unknown in racing world and was in Europe, Danny Sullivan and Gunnar Nielsen shared an apartment or a flat, as they call it there.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Now we come to California boy Richie Ginther. He gave Honda their first Grand Prix win in the 1965 Mexican Grand Prix. This was also the first Formula One win for a new tire entrant then, Goodyear. And Ginther died in 1989 while vacationing in France. Next is Peter Gethin, winner of the greatest and closest finishes, one of the greatest and closest finishes in Grand Prix history. His magical moment came at Monza in 1971, driving a BRM. In 1984, he was team manager of Tolman Formula One team, and one of his drivers was Ayrton Senna da Silva. And boy, do I remember that Segafredo Tolman Turbo. And I'm sure you do too.
Oh, exciting.
Vittorio Brambilla is next. The Monza Gorilla took his only win in the 1975 Austrian Grand Prix and then lost control and crashed his orange March after throwing both hands in the air upon taking the checkered flag. You know, so excited. And you can see the clip of this on YouTube. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah, a number of these clips are available on YouTube.
Yeah, very true. He was born and raised in Monza and died there in 2001 from a heart attack. Next is fellow Italian Giancarlo Bugatti. From Reims 1961 to this day, this Italian driver remains the only person to win a Formula One championship race on his Grand Prix debut. Driving a Ferrari and in second place going into the final corner of the final lap, you know, the Tailwheel corner, he slipstreamed and passed Dan Gurney at the finish to earn a place in motor racing history. Bugatti passed away in 1995. And, you know, another interesting thing about him, before, you know, in the old days they used to have a lot of non-championship Formula One races. Mm-hmm. This was actually his third Formula One race. And guess where he finished in his first two Formula One races? He won both of them.
What a professional.
Yeah, so he won three straight Formula One races. The third one just happened to be a championship race. Next, we come to Innes, Ireland. Scottish driver gave Team Lotus their first win in Grand Prix racing at the first Watkins Glen Stage U.S. Grand Prix in 1961. Ireland was very bitter for many years with team boss Colin Chapman for giving what he thought was more attention and preferential treatment to another Scottish driver, Jim Clark. And who can blame Chapman for that, you know? Ireland wrote Grand Prix stories for Road and Track magazine in this country in his post-racing career and died of cancer in 1993. Next, Ludovico Scarfiotti. He was the nephew of then-feared boss Gianni Agnelli and last Italian to win the Italian Grand Prix. This was achieved at Monza in 1966, driving a Ferrari. Scarfiotti also won the 1963 Le Mans 24-hour race, and he was killed in a hill climb event in Rossfeld, Germany, 1968, driving a Porsche. Next, we come to Carlos Pache of Brazil, also known as Moco. He was one of two Carloses on Bernie Ecclestone's Brabham team back then. His greatest moment came at the track now named in his memory, Interlagos. His victory on home soil in 1975 was scored over another local driver, Emerson Fittipaldi. And of course, the other Carlos on the team was Carlos Alberto Reutemann from Argentina. And Pasha, unfortunately, was killed in a small plane crash in Sao Paulo in March 1977. Next is Jochen Mass from Germany. The tragic Spanish Grand Prix of 1975 at the beautiful Montjuïc Park in Barcelona was his only success. The race was stopped because Rolf Stommelin had crashed very heavily and some people were killed. And this race, I believe, remains the only one where half points were awarded. Mass was born in Munich, Germany, and he was also involved, unfortunately, in the accident which killed Gilles Villeneuve, and he was winner of the 1989 Le Mans in a Sauber Mercedes. Okay, Clark, now we come to another of your homeboys, one-hit wonder, Olivier Panis. Like his fellow Frenchman Jean-Pierre Baltoise many years earlier, Panis' only win came in the rain at Monaco in 1996. He was at the wheel of a Mugen Honda-powered Ligier, and this was also the final win for Ligier team. And as you know, Panis drove for BAR and Honda in Formula 1 and also as a test driver, and now enjoying his life after Formula 1. Next is Piero Taruffi, famous for his book, Techniques of Motor Racing. This is a very, very famous book in motor racing that he wrote. Taruffi won the opening round of the 1952 season. Now, guess when the 52 season started, which month?
May.
Very good. The Swiss Grand Prix at Bremgarten, driving a Ferrari. He also won the Targa Florio, driving a Lancia in 1954, and the final Mille Miglia in 1957. At the wheel of a Ferrari. Luigi Musso, this is a shared win. This Italian driver is credited with one win after Juan Manuel Fangio took over his car, the Lancia Ferrari D50, and won the 1956 Argentine Grand Prix. Musso also won the 1958 Targa Florio race in Sicily, but was killed the same year in the French Grand Prix at Reims, also known as Reims. Okay, next we go to another Italian one-hit wonder, still racing, Jarno Trulli, world karting champion from Pescara and now driving for Toyota. Trulli scored his first and so far only win, and this was a very special Grand Prix, Monaco in 2004, and this is the race where Michael Schumacher collided with, what a surprise, Juan Pablo Montoya in the tunnel under a caution.
And we have to remember that this time it wasn't Juan Pablo Montoya's fault.
No, for once. Actually, twice. The incident in Sao Paulo with Jos Verstappen, and Jos Verstappen told me himself that was his fault. So Monty gets a clean bill for once. And finally, we come to our man also racing, Jenson Button, as David Hobbs would call him, Jenson Button. Our Jens, after over 100 Grand Prix races, finally takes the win in a wet Hungarian Grand Prix in 2006 for Honda. Somewhat lucky win, or should I say a somewhat lucky strike win, but still a very popular win. Button made his Grand Prix debut in the 2000 Australian Grand Prix at the age of 20. But the way that this season is going, looks like sun is setting on Jenson Button's career in a team from the land of rising sun. And with that, curtain comes down on another edition of A Moment in Motor Racing History. Thank you for listening. Also, Clark, I would like to thank some of our listeners, Mike Dodson, for referring me to a story that came in the May 8th edition of Wall Street Journal regarding the waiting list for Ferrari. And this gentleman had also referred me to the story on A1GP, which appeared in the April 24th issue of Wall Street Journal. So thank you, Mike. Our man Chris in Louisiana, auto racer, he is interested in people calling in or writing a forum as to their favorite Indy 500, and my favorite of all time, the finish, is the 1982 Gordon John Cock and Rick Mears. So if anybody wants to put it on the forum or send us email, which Indy 500 was the greatest finish, we'll be very interested in hearing and mention some of them on the air. And also would like to thank our man in Holland, Mr. Alvin. Haha. Correction here. He pointed out that Nico Hülkenberg, the Hulk, they are now calling him Hulk, and he was in the news today.
We mentioned that.
I'm sure you did. And that he is in Euro Formula 3 this year and not World Series by Renault, as we had mentioned in the previous podcast. So keep up the sharp listening, Mr. Elvin. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Thank you, Nasser. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Here's your F1 trivia answer. Jacques Villeneuve in a Williams was first to set a time of 1:21.072. 28 minutes later, Michael Schumacher in his Ferrari posted an identical time. Then, with 9 minutes of the session remaining, the other Williams driver, Heinz-Harald Frentzen, crossed the line, again with the same time. According to the regulations, in the event of drivers setting equal times in qualifying, the first driver to set the time is given precedence. Therefore, Villeneuve was on pole, Schumacher was in second place, and Frentzen third.
Welcome back to F1Weekly.com. Clark Rogers here, your host. And now we're going to go into the wrap-up, as we always do. I want to thank... And now, as we always do, we're going to go to some email. Steven?
Our first email is from Jerry Moore, and he writes, F1 Trivia. Clark, an interesting bit of trivia you may or may not want to use for a future podcast. An associate of mine was in Beverly Hills last weekend and noticed an open house. When he discovered the asking price was $1.4 million, he decided it was a little bit out of his price range, but the agent invited him in to take a look around anyway. While touring the house, he noticed that every room contained a scale model car, and all of them were Ferraris. Upon leaving, he asked the agent who was selling the house. The agent replied, Michael Schumacher. Quick, let's run down there and see if we can get a tour of Michael Schumacher's house in Beverly Hills. And the next one is from Juan Carlos in San Jose, Costa Rica. Hello, Clark. I listen every week to your podcast from San Jose, Costa Rica. My country is not really a very big follower of Formula One, basically since we have never had any national drivers get to that level. And, of course, there are no races near where we are located here in Central America. But today, we, the followers of motorsport, and especially Formula One, had a chance to experience up close the energy and excitement of seeing a Formula One car speed by. Today, May 6th, Red Bull Racing brought one of the 2006 cars to the streets of San Jose for an exhibition demonstration. This was intended to get more following for the sport from the people of our country and to promote driving safety, or driving safely. It also gave lots of people a chance to see and hear an F1 car for real and not only on the TV. Hopefully, this will not be the only time something like this happens and will make this sport much more popular here. Just wanted to let you know about this and tell you, keep up the good work. Thank you, Juan. That would be cool.
That must have been exciting for them, those screaming V10s.
Yeah, down in Costa Rica, I've had a couple friends going down a really nice place. Good place to visit.
Big lizards. Big lizards. Okay, our final email, which I'm going to read because it has some interesting thoughts about what this show really is. So I always take these kinds of emails very seriously, and I do enjoy reading them. Okay, this is from Charles Warner. After listening to podcast number 160, I have to say I'll probably stop listening to your podcasts. It would seem they should be retitled The Clark Rogers Show, and a bit about Formula One. The pedantic and often puerile rantings, and forgive me if I'm not pronouncing those small but large words incorrectly, of Clark, not to mention the affectations of foreign accents, along with disparaging remarks regarding almost anyone in general, have finally put me off. This really came to light just before the last race when Clark and the others continued to rail against Felipe Massa, explaining how scared he was and how incompetent and he was going to be toast. Viewpoints are fine, even obviously biased ones. However, after Massa's fine performance, very little was credited to him and certainly no crow was eaten. Unfortunately, the show has become a sort of Huey, Dewey, and Louie show, with childish and meaningless banter from Clark, Steve, and Nasser in a so-there atmosphere. Nasser seems to try to report, although an interview with a hockey announcer seems far off base, but should really have known that Divina currently is active in our HGP group in her 79 Lotus. There are many of us that would be willing to talk about the vintage aspect of Formula One. Yes, you spoke with Phil Riley and Bud Moeller. There are a lot more of us, as well as others in the sport. I enjoy Desiree's bits on the locations of the races, nice cultural perspective, and while I'm ranting, please learn the names of the drivers. It's Liuzzi, not Luisi. I realize that it's your show, and you could put it on any way you wish. I just don't have to listen. Over the last year, it has steadily gone downhill with the screams of interjected pseudo-French accented statements, etc. Go back to what attracted many of us. Some personal opinionating is fine, but it has taken over the show. Listen to 160, and you'll see what not to do. From Desiree, Nasser, Steve, David Tapia, Toby, and Brian Thomas, good night.
This is Desiree for F1Weekly.com, thanking you, the subscribers and members of our listening audience, for listening to our podcast, reporting and commenting on Formula One, the highest echelon of motorsport, a blend of technology, tradition, glamour, and guts, all wrapped up in a high-speed package. That's F1Weekly.com for all your Formula One needs.